Good evening, James McCanny here, going right into the show, January 1st, 2009, and what an incredible year last year, 2008. We'll talk a little bit about that. I know you've lived that enough, but the reason I want to mention 2008 is because we have quite a mess just about wall to wall, ceiling to ceiling in this world, and the world of science is really in a quagmire. It is stuck, it is owned, and what do we do to progress? That is the question. How can anybody progress in this stifling atmosphere of ownership of science where scientists and their science is very much owned? I'm going to talk about Yellowstone, the earthquakes this past week, and internet eavesdropping. Is your internet privacy being held around the as you surf the internet, as you go places on the internet? And so I'll be discussing these. First, a few quick announcements. By the way, I have to mention this. The ads you hear right before my show, those are not my ads. And I sell Dalton water filters, of course, so at times some people get confused as to whose ads are whose. The black filters, I no longer sell those. And so at any rate, I'll talk a little bit more later in the show about the Dalton water filters. And the of course, as most of you know, hopefully by now, the personal Dalton water filter, the 1 liter Dalton personal travel and emergency water filter, they're back in stock. And we ran out last fall, unfortunately, and but those are back in stock now. I'll talk about those in a few minutes. But interesting story on that. One truck driver I talked to bought two of them, and they have the big cup holders in the trucks. I said, well, these are 3.5 inches in diameter, and so they're getting one for each side of the truck so they can have a personalized water filter as they drive down the road, because as they know, in the same conversation, this one truck driver was telling me that they watch the jet streams or the spraying in the atmosphere. They look like jet streams, but actually are clouds coming out of airplanes that, of course, a guy named Cliff Carnicom has done a lot of work on that. I've been on radio shows with him. But the truck driver was telling me of the increased levels when he drives between Texas and Denver, and I believe some other locations in the Midwest, but they are, of course, out in the open, driving every day, seeing these. So they wanted the personal Dalton water filters, one on each side of the truck, so they're working all of the time filtering water, and so they know that they're getting clean, fresh water, because even with bottled water, you simply don't know what you're getting. A few quick announcements here. Remember that I said a long time ago that industries would be grabbing the green label. They would be talking about green, and you see it on TV. Now every computer, every server, every company out there today is trying to give a green label to their business, saving power, all of these different advertising techniques. And so one has to wonder, are they really green, or is that just a lot of promotion? And I said before that would be just a marketing hype issue, and that's exactly what's going on. So the only things that are really green are probably the things that were green before, about 1 year ago, when the marketing corporations picked up on this. So at any rate, I just was checking some of the equipment in the studio here. Sorry for that little delay. Also, I'm going to talk about 2012 a bit, because more and more people are trying to market 2012 and sell that package, which, as I've said repeatedly, is really has no validity. The Mayan calendar doesn't predict disaster in 2012. There is no magical galactic alignment. I'll talk a little bit about that. But let me start out with Yellowstone, talking about that, because that definitely is in the minds of many people out there at this time. The since December 26th, there has been what they call a swarm of earthquakes under the northern limb of Yellowstone Lake. So for people who are not familiar with the geography of Yellowstone Park, it's in the state of Wyoming near the eastern border. It borders Idaho, Montana, and it's actually in the state of Wyoming. But the northern, the lake looks kind of like a person sitting on a chair with the two legs sticking out towards the south. And then there's a western arm, and then the northern arm would be something like the head of the person sitting on a chair. And that is where all of the recent earthquake activity has been. Hundreds of earthquakes. Now, let me preface this by saying that this is somewhat common out there, although the recent swarm of earthquakes is a bit larger than normal. The earthquake swarm, some of them reaching close to 4.0 on the Richter scale, which, remember, on the old Richter scale would have been a 5.0. Remember the old earthquakes back 10 years ago or 20 years ago? They've reduced the numbers on the Richter scale to minimize what people think, and they go, oh, it's only a 3.9 on the Richter scale. That's the maximum that the U.S. Geological Survey has reported in this last swarm of earthquakes from Yellowstone National Park over the past week or so. Actually, since, like I say, the 26th, the day after Christmas. But the point is that on the old Richter scale, that would have been a 4.9. That would have been enough to rock most major cities and possibly topple buildings. But of course, it's in the middle of Yellowstone National Park, where there is not a lot of what you would call earthquake-prone buildings that would be prone to damage during an earthquake. But to talk about this, I wanted to go back a little bit in the history of Yellowstone. And, of course, there have been major eruptions there in history. One of the eruptions in that region, not exactly in the Yellowstone caldera itself, but a nearby volcano went off about 75 million years ago and was responsible for a large deposit of ash that extends all the way to eastern Nebraska. Now, that's a pretty healthy volcano. Now, let me also mention that most of the volcanoes, let's talk about Mount St. Helens, we're pretty familiar with that. People in New York City were bottling the ash from Mount St. Helens when it erupted this in recent history. People in New York City were actually filling little vials, glass vials, with the dust, with the ash fallout from Mount St. Helens. Now, the Wyoming volcano that erupted, tens of millions of years ago, the reason they were cognizant of this is because in eastern Nebraska, there is a museum built around a dinosaur grave pit where the ash came down, basically killed the dinosaurs with the pyroclastic blast, and the ash and the hot ash basically preserved those dinosaurs up until they were discovered recently in the history of modern man. So eastern Nebraska is quite a long ways from Wyoming. But the point is that most of those volcanoes erupted without a lake in the caldera. Now, the caldera, of course, is the zone where typically it drops down. The magma is released, and then there's usually a sinking phenomenon that occurs after most eruptions. Remember that when Cortez came to Mexico City, when he first visited Mexico City a long time ago, back in the, of course, the 1500s, then they found the Aztecs. The Aztecs were living in the caldera, which is now Mexico City. There was a lake there. They had their structures built on the higher ground and had dike work, roads built to navigate, and they were also had small boats where they could navigate in the lake area, but that eventually, of course, dried up. But one of the larger volcanic calderas on the earth is the caldera that Mexico City sits in. But the Yellowstone caldera is literally the biggest volcanic caldera on the planet. It takes up about a tenth of the western part of the state of Wyoming. And towards the eastern end of that giant caldera is the lake, the Yellowstone Lake. Now, here's the problem with having water associated with a volcano. The power that drives volcanoes comes typically from water, where it sinks down into a fissure, gets down into the ground, gets down, touches the magma, and that superheated steam is what blows the top off of a mountainside. Now, most people have seen the fantastic video footage of Mount St. Helens as it blew the entire side out of that mountain. Of course, this past year we saw a whole series of eruptions in South America, in the southern regions of South America, and those volcanoes, of course, blew ash and magma and debris up into the stratosphere. So there's a tremendous amount of energy involved here. The problem with Yellowstone, of course, if you convert the water in Lake Yellowstone to steam, in other words, if there was a fissure large enough to where a good portion of this lake would then drain down into the magma below, this would become one of the largest volcanic eruptions the Earth has ever known. So a long time ago, I remember I was on a radio show with my good friend Alex Merklinger. Many of you remember him. And I was on a show talking about this with Alex. I've been on the Coast to Coast show talking about this, that there is a need to drain the water out of Yellowstone Lake. There's, of course, the lake is highly polluted now due to the gases, the poisonous gases that came from underground and polluted the water. And so in recent years, all the fish have died. Many of the buffalo have died around that area. And much of that area is restricted. I've also charted out a path out of the southern end of Yellowstone Lake where, using a siphoning technique with a big tube, the kind of tubes that you move oil or natural gas, you could siphon off a good portion of the water and it would drain down through the southern region of Wyoming and off to the Pacific Ocean. Now, when I first started recommending this as a requirement for the planet, people said, well, you can't take a beautiful lake like Yellowstone and drain it off. But now, obviously, it's poisoned, making a much worse pollution event. So, once again, what's happening right now is the people who are watching the caldera, although I'm sure they have good intentions, are really missing the boat. And once again, here's where politicians who are in charge of our country and our world are simply totally out of touch with what's happening in when it comes to natural disasters, which brings up a very good point. As we move into the future, everybody, I believe, that I've talked to, including my the close friends, people on radio, people who are scientists, they are pretty much convinced that Earth is, its time is, its days are numbered, so to speak, for natural events. And there are many kinds of natural events. We know throughout history there have been numerous volcanic eruptions that have created cooling periods during the Earth. And in the 1800s, back in the Middle Ages, there were epochs where the temperature of the Earth cooled and there was blocking of the sunlight. So there was there was starvation around the world due to this. And today it's no different. We don't have the technology to grow food for the entire planet if the sunlight is blotted out. So the point is that we could minimize the damage from a volcanic eruption from Yellowstone if we could drain the water out of that lake. And the reason is, of course, if the earthquakes start to break fissures in the ground and allow water to drop down into the magma, then it's going to create a chain reaction where there will be an explosion which will cause more water to drop down. And this will continue until the entire lake is drained into the magma. And if you turn that much water into steam, it's going to be a major disaster of worldwide proportions. And the Earth would not recover from this for decades and decades and decades. In fact, if there were a major eruption, it has been estimated that the ash cloud up to many feet deep would go as far as eastern Wisconsin. So that would be a major disaster for this entire region. I noticed in reading the U.S. Geological Survey notes regarding this recent swarm of earthquakes that they're talking about advising Homeland Security. There's actually an Office of Homeland Security associated with the lake. But I also, before the show, I looked up on the major news media, and I really didn't find a great deal of coverage of this event. And I'm sure they're trying to state, in fact, it states right in the U.S. Geological Survey that the earthquakes, they really don't know where this is going, but they say there is minimal probability of earthquakes or of volcanic eruptions. And I really don't know where they get this information. It's kind of like scientists seeing a new find of either archaeology or of planets or of some item, and they put a date on it. And it's the same kind of mentality that scientists have a set dogma that they want to live by. And of course, in this case, scientists are told to minimize any public disclosure that might lead to, say, a panic. But the point here, once again, with the Yellowstone Lake is it should be drained, even though it is fairly polluted at this point. Drain it away from that location, drain the water, find a location away from the fissured areas around the main Yellowstone caldera, and minimize the impact if, in fact, we do have major earthquakes which would lead to volcanic eruptions. So, at any rate, that's the report. I just also do give a little bit of history here. The major eruptions in somewhat recent history, around 2 million years ago, there was a rift created. The caldera from that eruption was about 75 kilometers long. Around 1 million years ago, there was a rift that occurred, creating a 16-kilometer caldera. And 64,000 years ago, there was another eruption of what is noted here as 100 cubic kilometers of lava that belched forth from this. And the resulting caldera from that eruption was 45 by 85 kilometers. These are huge. These are enormous, enormous eruptions on an Earth-wide scale. And then 150,000 years ago and about 70,000 years ago were other eruptions. And then, of course, every volcano on Earth, I've talked about this previously on my show, every volcano on Earth just about was going off during the Holocene period. That was the transition when the woolly mammoths died. And, of course, there's a reason for that. That's because these volcanoes erupted as a large, massive comet moved through the solar system, affecting planet Earth on a couple different occasions, causing those mass extinctions. In fact, man himself almost went extinct during that time frame. Now, that, of course, was only at most about 12,000 years ago. Many scientists put that as recent as 4,000 years ago. And there were many, many other Earth-wide effects that took place at that time. Even for standard science, many of the scientists who claim to be part of the standard scientific community understand that the glaciation that we're seeing today, the glaciers that are receding today, were formed fairly recently geologically. And even if it were 12,000 years ago, that is very recent when you're looking at scales of a million or 2 million or 3 million years or 60 million years, those type of time scales. 12,000 years is just but a couple seconds geologically. So these are fairly recent. And so the question is, could the caldera in Yellowstone National Park rupture? Could it drain that lake? And the answer is yes. And whether it happens today or tomorrow or next month or next year or in 100 years or in 5,000 years, the responsibility lies on the current population to resolve this issue. You don't let a lake the size of Yellowstone Lake sit on top of an active caldera. Anybody that would do that is negligent. This is just absolute gross negligence, putting their head in the sand and ignoring the obvious. So to move that water off to a less volatile area, in fact, if the water were moved, the polluted water would eventually clean itself out. The minerals in the ground, etc., would leach out the pollution in the water. And eventually that would become clean water again. So one route would be to take it all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Another route would be to just take it into southern Wyoming and park it there, but certainly move it away from the active caldera region. And as I said, the 200-plus earthquakes that occurred over the past week are in the northern part, the northern branch, so to speak, of Yellowstone Lake. And by the way, if you go on the internet, you can see all of the same pictures I'm looking at. The website is the utah.edu site, SEIS. Let me give this just so people can go there. SEIS.utah, U-T-A-H, the state, .edu. And they have a geological department there that monitors the calderas. The other place you can go is simply to, let me see if I have that link handy here. Excuse me, looking through my notes. I don't have that handy here, but I'll hopefully have that before the end of the show. Let me see. I'll pull that before the end of the show so people can actually go and look at these maps and see where the caldera is, etc. I'm going to branch off into a couple other topics here. I've covered those topics. The This is rather interesting. If you saw me before a show, getting ready, and all of the things that go into putting together the show, and all of the equipment issues that have to go into putting together the show, you would probably laugh. You'd see me running around putting papers in piles and organizing and stapling things, and you'd probably get a kick out of actually seeing what goes on behind the scenes here. Okay, this is something many people wrote in about this past week. It's talking about Venus and the solar wind stripping the atmosphere away from Venus. Got quite a few emails on this. On CNN.com, the website, the web news site, there's a series of pictures that they always have. It's like the week in space, and usually some nice pretty pictures of other moons, other planets, etc. But this one caught my eye, and apparently the eye of quite a few people out there in the audience. So at any rate, the picture is of Venus. Now, Venus, of course, is a planet with a gigantic atmosphere, 1,000 times larger than Earth, even though Venus itself is quite a bit smaller than Earth. And physically, the planet core, or the actual physical planet, is quite a bit smaller than Earth. It's bigger than Mars, but Venus, the physical planet, is smaller than Earth, yet Venus has an atmosphere tremendously hot enough to melt lead, and it is very extensive, thousands of times denser than Earth's atmosphere. So at any rate, this picture, as they're quoting here, now they say that the space agencies around the globe capture remarkable images of stars, planets, galaxies, and other objects. Here are some of our favorites. Now, this is a total piece of misinformation, and I'll tell you why. Now, you look at the picture, and most people are going to look at that and go, "Woo, that's a picture of Venus with the solar wind blowing the atmosphere off of Venus." But then you read at the bottom, in fine print, it says, "This still shot of a European Space Agency animation." This is a drawing. It's a very nice drawing, but it's not a picture of Venus. It's not an image of stars, planets, and galaxies that the space agency has procured with a spacecraft. It's an animation. And they're stating that this solar wind, the wind that comes out of the sun, is stripping Venus of its atmospheric gases. And then it says, "While Earth has a magnetic field to prevent this phenomenon, Venus and Mars do not." And so right there you see a major contradiction. Earth is much farther from the sun than Venus. So if this amazing atmospheric displacement is occurring on Venus, why does it have an atmosphere thousands of times larger than Earth's? If there's no magnetic field to protect it, and there has been no magnetic field to protect it for 4.5 billion years, then certainly this atmosphere should have worn off. But of course, that contradiction is not talked about, it's not mentioned. But what's striking here is this is an animation, and they're trying to portray it as a real picture of the planet Venus. It's bad science, and this is what's been going on for decades and decades. The actual physical situation, now imagine this. Venus is closest to the sun, and it has the largest atmosphere. Earth is a little is farther away than Venus from the sun, and it has a modest atmosphere by planetary standards, and Mars has quite a small atmosphere. So that's exactly backwards of what you would expect if the solar wind, in fact, was taking the atmosphere off. You would expect Mars to have a much larger atmosphere, and we know that Mars did have an atmosphere at one time because it had oceans. And to hold those oceans in place, one would need a vast atmosphere to the atmospheric pressure to hold the water in place. And this is another contradiction that I've been pointing out for a very long time. The fact that Mars would have needed an atmosphere to keep its oceans in place. So a number of years ago, some NASA scientists said, well, the reason Mars doesn't have an atmosphere is because there must have been an incredible solar blast at one time, and that took away the atmosphere of Mars, because they recognized that I was correct in criticizing the standard scientific theoretical work. And so they tried to say, oh, well, this mysterious and magical blast from the sun took the atmosphere of Mars away. But wait a minute. Then why did it leave a tremendous atmosphere on Venus and a pretty good atmosphere on Earth? And when you have that kind of a solar blast coming by, Earth's little magnetic field would be no match for that. So why would Earth have an atmosphere? We're much closer to the sun, and Venus is much closer to the sun than we are. So the planetary atmospheres of the inner planets, Venus, Earth, and Mars, are totally backwards. And given this animation, I'm just trying to figure out what they are trying to portray here. What is the point? So for all the people who emailed that picture in, as you can see, total misinformation, and it's always very subtle. But why on earth are they trying to pose an animation as an image? That I don't understand, but that also leads to the point of 2012. I'll just briefly mention this, and I'll probably talk about this on almost every show from now on, because you're going to hear more and more and more, especially in the year 2009. So I guess there's some new videos and DVDs out talking about 2012 and how the Earth is going to end, and every possible disaster you can imagine is occurring, and that everybody from Nostradamus to who knows who is predicting that 2012 is the end of the Earth. So why all the focus on 2012? Well, human nature is such that you wouldn't normally prepare until right before the event. If you knew that December 21st, 2012, the Earth was going to end, you would probably put off any preparation until then, correct? Well, then if the real events happen before then, guess what? The vast majority of people will be totally unprepared, and that's the point. That's what I've said all along. That's the Y2K was a total misinformation event. There was no reason for computer systems to crash on the turning of the century in the year 2000 any more than there would be on the year 2010, or any other year. Computer registers turn over all the time. They're not infinite in size. And computer, when you convert the year 2000 into digital binary, it does not turn out to be all zero. So it's pretty ridiculous, and of course nothing happened then. A lot of people made a lot of money selling emergency equipment and goods back then, but there was nothing to it. Now there was another disinformation campaign revolving around May 15th, 2003, when Planet X was supposed to come and destroy Earth, and of course it didn't. There's a lot of people talking about Planet X coming in 2012. Well, if have a friend who's a talk show host, and he's made a point of trying to call up a lot of these people who are making such claims to get them on the show to basically ask them pointed questions, not to ridicule, but to ask pointed questions. And it's very interesting that to the letter, these people have denied or turned down the chance to be on the radio, to be interviewed. And of course, when scrutinized, they really don't have any solid information. And as Lyndon Johnson once said, if you repeat something enough times, and everybody starts repeating it, all of a sudden it becomes the truth. And that's the simply the case with 2012. So I don't want to belabor that, but you're just going to get pounded with that over and over and over again. Now, at the beginning of the show, I said I'm going to try and talk a little bit about how can we progress in this age of misinformation, in an age where science is totally owned by government funding, and the ability to do science is owned. Now, if you look on, say, search the internet on my name, of course, you come up with all kinds of misinformation. That isn't out there by mistake. That has been placed there intentionally to put incorrect information out on someone who's trying to bring truthful information to the public. And why don't they want truthful information? Well, because imagine all of the scientists starting to wake up one day and say, you know, I'm not going to this job. I'm not going to go and perform these. I'm not going to produce my talents to create science, to create engineering that I don't have control over. And that's the key issue here. I was talking with a scientist this past week, someone I've known for many, many years, and we were talking about patent rights and who gets the patent rights in a corporation and the way documents are signed, etc., when someone works for a corporation. The issue is who really owns that person's work. And, of course, the corporation in general does. Sometimes people will retain patent rights. But in general, now let's take the case where someone publishes a paper in a scientific journal. There are all the time I'm getting requests from people to have certain parts of my work published in journals. And what happens when you do that, you give a certain release of that information to the journal. That's why I publish my own work. That's why I distribute it myself. That's why I control my information. That's why I control the science that I develop. And a lot goes on behind the scenes, unfortunately, that the public isn't able to see, but that's the way the world has to work these days. So the question is, how can the world progress? And the answer is that the science that's being developed, the innovations that are being developed, have to be performed by people who are going out on their own and developing. They have vision, and they work in relatively small groups of people. The conglomerate, the massive employment agencies like NASA, typically, most, I would say 99.9% of all of the money spent in those agencies is simply wasted. It doesn't go to true science. And that's why I gave a talk one time a number of years ago in front of a large group of people, and a large segment of that audience was professional scientists who had come to hear me talk. And I said, the real bill for a real space program could be done for a few hundred million dollars. And everybody was wondering, how could you possibly do this? Well, the point is that what you need to develop a program, you need resources, you need talent, you need the time and talent of engineers who know their field. But the bottom line is there is so much waste, there is so much overhead in an agency like NASA. You could literally duplicate what they are doing for a fraction of the cost. So you can see that a real space program with a few individuals that have insight could be done for a very low price tag. And so the question is, how does one progress? How does one take and move into the future when there's a domination of science, and the people who are, say, the European bankers who control the banking system, one of their main goals behind the scenes is to control education, to control science, to control engineering, and to keep all of these worker bees compartmentalized and isolated so they never, ever see the big picture. So how can one progress in this stifling atmosphere? Well, the answer is, first of all, you need a few innovative people that are willing to go out and work. Those few people have to be very knowledgeable about how the world works, because as soon as you start to succeed, you will have dozens and dozens of attempts to infiltrate what you do. People trying to associate with you, people trying to help you out, so to speak. There's all kinds of mechanisms that are used, and all of those produce one end result. It's what we call in the business compromised. Compromised is a term that's used in security agencies, in government agencies, etc. Compromised is where you get something on another person, you get attached to them, you infiltrate them, and you compromise them. And there are a million techniques to compromise scientists, scientific efforts, and that's why there is what you call Tier 1 science. And I've said before, these scientists intermingle with regular scientists because they're pulling out information, making sure everybody is remaining compartmentalized and not getting out of their little box, because they know that any one of those scientists, if they took their innovation, if they took their thoughts and moved it in a different direction, that they would be able to produce a tremendous amount of competing science, and that's something that is under tight control. So if the scientists who work for the Air Force labs, or if you're working in, say, Berkeley, as in one of the physics, you're a young PhD physicist working for a professor, all of this science, all of the labors are owned. All of the direction is, and they keep these people always grasping for that next paycheck, for that next project that they can develop. And as they work up through the system, as they become more and more compromised, that's when they get more and more ability to get grants, get money, and do so-called independent research, because it's not really independent research. It's very much owned from top to bottom. But you can't just come out and give young scientists that responsibility, because one of them is going to figure out that he's really not going to follow this track. They have to get scientists embedded and far along in their careers until they are totally compromised. Then you can start giving them big grants. You can fly them around the world, put their names in lights, and they'll do a lot of good work for you because they are compromised. So how does a group of engineers, how do they get totally separate? Well, in my personal career, I saw this going on firsthand. And the other thing I had that most of these people don't have, I was able to see beyond it, and I had something called integrity, that I wouldn't fall for these tricks that I kept seeing people. And at the time when I was young, something just didn't smell right about certain business deals people were offering me. And I would say, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't know why. It just doesn't seem right. And now that I'm older and more experienced, I know what was going on. They recognized my work as important, as integral, and important to development, many of the things going on behind the scenes, but they wanted to compromise me. They wanted to own me. They wanted to own my mind and own what I performed, the work I performed, and the innovations that I was coming up with. And so how do you progress in a world that is owned, dominated by money, grants, funding, and how does scientists progress in this? And the answer is that, first of all, you simply have to be independent. And the trouble with most new scientists is they're so naive. They come out of school, they get their degree. Before they know it, they are compromised. They're signing security agreements, that type of thing, that branch up into, say, federal funding agencies. And after they start signing these types of documents, then they have a string on them. They can always pull them back and say, look, you signed this document. You're not allowed to talk about such and such. And most people buy into that. They think, well, they're important. They have a security clearance. And so once again, then they become compartmentalized. Then they get, as they become compromised, they get more funding. They get more ability to publish. But note that all of what they do is owned by someone else. And they really don't have control over what happens to their innovations. So anyway, that's a little diversion. It's a very complex world when you get out into the world of venture capital and financing and new products and new innovations. Who owns it and who wants to prevent new innovations from coming along? Because it would make life easier for the general public. Of course, there are many disinformation sites. Let's take energy, which is a huge expense. It's one of the dominant expenses in modern man's life. There are websites that appear to be dedicated to promoting finding solutions for energy so that we can get away from oil and nuclear and coal, when in reality these sites are tightly controlled and monitored by the people in those very industries. So it's a very deceptive world we live in, and when you're a scientist trying to work through this maze, it's even more complicated. So once again, the question, how can the human race progress in the stifling atmosphere that's being controlled and dominated by large corporations, large corporate interests, bankers with interest in dominating the public and keeping the public sequestered, etc., etc. Anyway, I think you get the idea. And so now I'm just going to branch off and talk about a couple other small items. By the way, I said I would mention the Personal Dalton water filters. They're 7 inches tall when they're folded up, 3.5 inches in diameter, and they're about a foot tall. They're stainless steel. They contain one gravity ceramic water filter element, and they'll produce about a liter of water in about a couple hours. And by the way, there is a reason why gravity feed water filters take time, because the water flowing through at a slow pace, it's required, especially when you have extremely small pore sizes, as in the ceramic filter. Inside the ceramic filter casing is the black carbon, which takes out chemical elements, and then inside of that is another ceramic casing. There's a reason why the Dalton water filters have been successful for 150 plus years, and they're still the choice of emergency agencies around the world. The number one thing you have to understand is that the flow rate is set for a very good reason. You don't want to speed up the process, because the faster the water flows through, the less effective it is. And that's why gravity feed water filter elements are manufactured much differently than high pressure water filter elements. So at any rate, just wanted to make that point, that there is a very specific flow rate for gravity water filters. And there's a reason for that. There's a scientific reason. And that's why the Dalton three-part filter, it's the only one I recommend. It's the only one I sell. And the Personal Dalton travel emergency water filter uses one of them. And, of course, the full-size unit uses up to four. You can use one, two, three, or four. And I personally just use one filter element in my larger unit that I use in the kitchen, or also for emergency. And the number one thing I look at when I look at a water filter element, is it cleanable? Is it cleanable? In other words, can you lightly rub the outer shell and then reuse that same filter element? The Daltons you can, and of course the problem with the black filters is that they are not cleanable. And they, once they're clogged up, and that can happen, as I found out in the Iowa testing last spring, can happen very quickly, especially in the sludge conditions that we saw in Iowa. And a lot of people wonder, well, wasn't this testing done before? And the actual answer is that I had to go out and do this myself to really learn the hard way. And we didn't really have those kind of conditions until last spring, where I was able to personally go out and test those in the field. And, of course, the Dalton ceramic water filters, we cleaned them dozens, if not hundreds of times, and they came right back and filtered water at the same rate. They did not plug up. So at any rate, the personal 1 liter Dalton travel emergency water filter is $89.95. plus $10 shipping, and the full-size water filter with the four elements that comes with four standard 7-inch ceramic filter elements. And as I said, you can use one or two, depending on the flow rate that you need. $319, plus $59 extra for the fluoride arsenic add-on filters. That's $59 for a pair of those. And remember that shipping to Canada for the full-size system is just $21 flat rate and $41 to all other foreign destinations flat rate. That takes the fear out of the foreign shipping of the gravity feed water filters. And so once again, go to my webpage, JMCC, S is in Sam, C is in Charlie, I is in Indigo.com, just seven letters, JMCCSCI.com. short for J. McKinney Science, or the mailing address JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota 55392. Now, 2009, As I said before, 2008 was a very interesting year. I think a lot of people woke up in 2008. That's the only thing I can say, is that we have a lot more tuned and aware people out there today than we have ever had before. But what does 2009 have in store for us? Well, you can bet that there will be more foreclosures. I was talking to an analyst today, not the kind of analyst that you'll see on the evening news, but a real analyst, and they said that there are eight bubbles in the housing industry, as this is related to the short-term 5-year balloon loans that would cause the first bubbles to break. There are eight total because of the way they wrote the loans. We've been through two of them so far. The next one is going to hit sometime in February, then midsummer. And this cascading effect will just keep going as housing prices drop. Of course, you can listen to these type of economic projections any place, but the question is, how on earth are we going to manage as a civilization as the entire world economy collapses? Remember one key issue, this is all planned. Number two, you have to take care of yourself. So year 2009, if you are not already in a position to take care of yourself, that means turn off the utilities, turn off the water faucet, take care of yourself. You have to be your own source of clean, fresh water. You have to be your own source of food. You have to raise a garden. 2009, I predict, will be the year of the garden. Or families start to plow up part of their yard, and remember, call before you dig, or use a rototiller because there are electric lines and gas lines running through your yard. But the 2009 will be the year of the family garden. Bringing that back, learning how to regain those skills, growing crops, growing your food, storing the food, and basically most people would be hard-pressed to survive given the conditions they have right now. I made the effort, of course, last spring. I had the corn seed offer, and that was very successful. People really understood what I was doing. I've noticed now, when you go to buy seeds, beware. I've seen even reputable seed companies selling what they call organic seeds, and organic is okay, but that they are probably also hybrid seeds. Hybrid or non-hybrid is the issue. Organic is good. Organic just refers to the medium that the seeds were grown in or the plants were grown in. But non-GMO, non-genetically modified is the key. But I've also noticed that there are many people out there who claim non-GMO and really don't understand what they are dealing with. So it's really a buyer beware industry out there. You have to know who is in fact selling the reputable seeds, and remember, like with the corn seeds, you would need about 250 seeds minimum in a plot to have a good strong seed crop if you were raising them strictly for seeds. And there's a very definitive way to save the seeds. You don't just take a couple husks of corn and save all the seeds and say, well, I have my seed supply. You take a couple of kernels from every ear. So there's a lot that people have lost, a lot of information, a lot of gardening techniques that have simply been lost. This information is available if you seek it out. But I would say 2008 was a year of people waking up. 2009 will be a year of people learning how to take care of themselves, and that's what I'm going to concentrate on. Also, 2009 is the 30-year anniversary of my time at Cornell University, and so therefore the 30-year anniversary of the public release of the plasma discharge comet model. This is so important. It is the central key issue that really is with us today. Let's go back to the issue of 2012. When you look at disinformation, what do? They throw that topic up there, 2012, and then they put this entire entourage of phony topics around it. The Mayan calendar, galactic alignment, the tidal waves that mysteriously come out of nowhere. And the whole point is that all of the misinformation revolving around 2012 is very craftily designed to distract the public, to get them thinking over here when the real issue is very central. That's why I spent weeks and weeks and weeks this past year, from October through the end of the year, talking about comets and the effect of a large comet coming into the solar system and how it would affect Earth. What would you see? What would be the effects you would notice as an Earth dweller? And so that's why I spent a good deal of time this year. We can progress with a lot of new, more detailed topics. But at any rate, 2009, the year, 30-year anniversary of the plasma discharge comet model, and a year to learn how to take care of yourselves. So I hope this, every week I will attempt to work hard at this type of topic. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.